sponsored in part by Eli Lilly and Company. Do you think you might have migraine? Talk to your healthcare professional about your symptoms, the number of days they impact your life, and which treatment options might be best for you. Learn more at thinkmigraine.com. And the American Brain Foundation. For over 30 years, the foundation has worked with researchers to discover better treatment, prevention, and cures for brain diseases and disorders. Imagine life without brain disease. Learn more at AmericanBrainFoundation.org. The Epilepsy Foundation leads the fight to overcome the challenges of living with epilepsy and to accelerate therapies, stop seizures, find cures, and save lives. Visit epilepsy.com to find out how to get involved today. And by Neurelis, a leading neuroscience company focused on the development and commercialization of therapeutics for the treatment of epilepsy and other neurologic disorders. The company's unique drug portfolio strives to address unmet needs in patient care. Learn more at Neurelis.com.
Hi, I'm Dr. Joe Servin, a neurologist who practices at the Mayo Clinic in Jacksonville, Florida. This is What's Health Got to Do with It, which looks at where and how healthcare intersects with your life, helping you get the medical answers you want. Coming up, October is Breast Cancer Awareness Month, so we've decided to devote today's program to the topic. But first, Chuck Todd, the longtime host of NBC's Meet the Press, once said, "America has a love-hate relationship with celebrity. We love to follow celebrities, but we also love to mock them. And secretly, we believe we're better than they are." I personally believe that Mr. Todd is partially correct in his analysis. We Americans are obsessed with celebrities. Yet there is one very positive aspect in following famous people. Sometimes celebrities use their fame or platform to highlight a particular disease or condition. Highlighting personal struggles with a health condition, particularly ones in which preventative strategies exist, can save millions of lives. Such is the case for breast cancer. If you're of a certain age, you might remember this stunning announcement from President Ford during comments for an unrelated meeting he was having.
"I just returned from the hospital where I saw Betty as she came from the operating room. Dr. Lukash has assured me that she came through the operation all right."
This emotional admission of the then First Lady Betty Ford recovering from breast cancer surgery from the President of the United States, no less, was the first time a public figure of this caliber made a breast cancer announcement that literally changed lives. Since then, so many other celebrities have made similar pronouncements that the list is too long to name. But one notable exception is Katy Couric, who made headlines last week when she announced her breast cancer on her website in the form of an essay entitled, "Why Not Me?" Previously, she's also used her platform to emphasize the importance of screening for colon cancer after sharing that her husband was suffering from and would later succumb to it. So today, we're taking a closer look at how this disease impacts both women and men, as well as the latest in screening and treatment options. Joining us to start us off is Beth Boyer, a physician assistant at Mayo Clinic's Jacoby Center for Breast Health. Welcome, Beth.
Hi, thanks for having me.
It's so good to have you here. And Dr. Diane Johnson, she is at HCA Memorial Women's Center and the medical director of the breast center there. Dr. Johnson, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's so good to have you. Beth, I'm going to start with you. Start us off by defining as best you can the most basic of terms. What exactly is breast cancer?
Yeah, this is a question that I get asked a lot. Most simply, breast cancer is a disease of abnormal cell growth in the breast. When cell growth is out of control, it can create a mass or a tumor, and not all tumors are cancer. but cancerous tumors can harm the tissue and it can spread to other parts of the body. So breast cancer is abnormal cell growth from the breast that we have concern about spreading to other areas. Breast cancer is the most common cancer in women after skin cancer, and it can develop in different parts of the breast, with the most common being in the ducts, which are the tubes that carry milk to the nipple.
Got it. Thank you for starting us off. Dr. Johnson, kind of to riff off of that response, is there only one type of breast cancer, or are there several types? Because I know so many conditions, there's one word, but then there's all these other different types that have different meanings.
Right. There are several different types of breast cancer, but like Beth was saying, far and away, the most common is related to the ducts within the breast. But there are other parts of the breast in which cancers can develop, such as the lobules. You can also get cancers that arise within different types of cancers that arise within the ducts or within cysts in the breast. You can actually even get deposits of cancer from other sites that deposit into the breast and spread from some other type of cancer to the breast. Although all of those things are much, much less common than ductal cancer, which is the most common type. And most of the time when people say breast cancer, that's what they're referring to.
So just so I'm super clear, ductal forms of breast cancer is the most common type.
It is. It is. That would be far and away the most common type that we see. Probably second would be something called lobular carcinoma or lobular cancer. Would be the second most common type in the breast. And even within those types, there are many different characteristics of individual tumors. So you could have one ductal cancer that has certain characteristics and another ductal cancer that has different characteristics that can affect the way that they're treated and the way that they behave.
Got it. That helps me out so much. Beth, what's the prognosis? What's the survival rate for those with the diagnosis?
What you said, you know, prognosis, the way that we think of it in cancer care is the term survival. So the stage of the disease is one of the most important factors that we talk about when we think of survival. So I get a lot of my information from the National Cancer Institute data, and the relative survival over a 5-year period of time for women diagnosed with breast cancer is actually over 90%.
Wow.
I feel very fortunate to get to work with these women in fighting this cancer. But many of these women will live even longer than the 5 years that we define as survival. The American Cancer Society data shows that the 10-year survival rate for women diagnosed with breast cancer is 84%, and 15-year survival rate upwards of 80%. So really looking at the factor that impacts this survival is the extent of the cancer. 99% of women with localized cancer that's been confined to the breast are going to survive to that 5 years. But if we don't notice or diagnose this breast cancer until it's spread regionally to lymph nodes that are in the area close to the breast, that 5-year survival rate drops to about 86%. And if we don't catch this cancer until after it's already spread to distant areas of the body, other organs, other body types, right. We call this metastatic disease, that 5-year survival is much less. It's only 30%.
So clearly the earlier you get it, the better it's going to be.
Absolutely.
Beth, one quick follow-up on about the survival rate, and I have to ask the question. There seems to be a difference between certain ethnicities in terms of that survival rate. African-American women, certain Hispanic women, there seems to be that they have worse survival rates. Is that right? Or how does race and ethnicity play into this?
Yeah, you're right. Overall, non-Hispanic Black women are more likely to die from their breast cancer. Also, you know, the non-Hispanic Black women are more likely to get breast cancer at a younger age and may get a more aggressive type of breast cancer. You may have heard of triple negative breast cancers. Right. So, you know, that we do know plays a role into it. Another kind of heritage or racial background to think about is Ashkenazi Jewish heritage. Ashkenazi Jewish heritage has been linked to certain genetic mutations like the BRCA, BRCA gene, which a lot of people may have heard of.
Appreciate that. Dr. Johnson, so we just heard about prognosis, survival rates, but who is at risk for breast cancer? Who should be like, oh my goodness, this is an issue?
So the one thing that I do like to start out with is there are categories of people, and I'll talk about that in just a second, that are at a higher risk. But I also want to emphasize just to everyone that over 75% of the breast cancers that we diagnose occur in women with no identifiable risk factors. So just because you don't have some of the risk factors that I'm going to talk about here in a second doesn't mean you're off the hook. And just sort of going back to what was said a few minutes ago, what we want to do is detect breast cancer at its earliest stages when it's most treatable. And so by doing that, we can improve the survival. But in talking about risk factors, the number one risk factor is female biologic sex. Okay. So people that are assigned female at birth are at the higher risk just based on that. The next thing would be age. So the older you are, the higher your risk. And those are, of course, things that you really can't do anything about. But there are some other things. So family history, that's why it's important to know your family history, honestly, not just for breast cancer, but for many health conditions. It's a good idea to have an idea about what your family history is and how that's played out over time. And then, so family history is a big one. And then there are some modifiable risk factors. So things that you can do or not do that can influence your risk of getting breast cancer. So obtaining and maintaining a normal weight, avoiding or limiting alcohol, those are some things that can play into different types of breast cancer. Some have more influence or less depending on age and some other factors, but there are some things that you can do, you know, increasing, this is good for all cancers, increasing your intake of fruits, vegetables, nuts, seeds, and beans, and limiting your intake of processed foods and things like that. So there are some things you can do, but the other big one that you can't control that I forgot to mention that I will hear is dense breasts can also increase your risk of breast cancer.
I appreciate that. And one quick follow-up, Dr. Johnson, and this is because I know Beth brought up the BRCA gene. Who exactly should be getting tested for BRCA genes and breast cancer as part of this risk factor aspect of the condition?
Right. So, you know, anytime a person comes to our breast center for a mammogram, they're given a risk assessment. And it's based on demographic factors. It's based on things like age, family history, any prior history of genetics testing, things like that. And it can give you an estimated lifetime risk. Once that risk, estimated lifetime risk, gets to 20%, you're considered high risk. Those are people that may want to talk to their doctors about getting genetics counseling to see if genetics testing is appropriate for them. Also, after a diagnosis of breast cancer, there are specific criteria that your medical oncologist would have. So things like being 50 or younger, certain types of breast cancer might trigger the need for genetics testing. But anybody that has a strong family history and isn't sure about whether they might need genetics testing should talk to their doctor and get the appropriate referral to a genetics counselor if that's needed. And then the genetics counselor can go from there. They can do an in-depth analysis to get a really detailed family history and personal history and decide what testing, if any, needs to be done.
Beth, our guest at the end of this show is our own David Luckin, a man who has had breast cancer, I'm happy to say. And I guess I'm wondering if you could kind of address that question. What about men and breast cancer?
Yeah, so breast cancer, it can happen for men. Any human with breast tissue can get breast cancer. But less than 1% of all breast cancers happen in men. And that's only about 1 in 1,000 men. So as Dr. Johnson mentioned, being female is certainly a big risk factor, but certain men should be aware that they may have a higher risk. So again, I mentioned the Ashkenazi Jewish heritage because of that link to the gene mutations. So men who have a known Ashkenazi Jewish heritage or who have a strong family history of breast cancer should remain aware for changes for their body. You know, for men at high risk, it can be even recommended for them to have chest exams to look for breast cancer.
And to all of our listeners out there, you're listening to What's Health Got to Do with It on WJCT News 89.9. I'm Dr. Joe Servin, and if you're just joining us, we're talking about breast cancer as it's part of October Breast Cancer Awareness Month. And we want to hear from you. If you have an idea for future shows, tweet me at Jay Servin. Dr. Johnson, let's kind of switch our focus here from risk and prognosis to detection. How exactly is breast cancer detected?
So we prefer to detect breast cancer when it's only able to be seen on a screening mammogram. The number one way you can reduce your risk of dying from breast cancer is to get the recommended screening mammogram. And a screening mammogram is going to occur when you don't have any symptoms. So you can't feel a lump, your doctor doesn't feel a lump, you're not having any skin changes, nothing like that. You're completely fine. You go in for your mammogram, and if the goal of screening mammography is to detect cancer at its earliest stages. So that means that it's usually small. It usually hasn't spread like Beth was talking about. It's confined to a small area. That's when that cancer is going to be the most treatable and when the treatment won't be as drastic. So a smaller surgery, maybe you can avoid having to have some treatments that aren't necessarily very pleasant, like chemotherapy, things like that. So the earlier we catch the cancer, the better. And that's the goal of screening mammography.
Got it. Beth, describe for us if there are any specific symptoms of breast cancer.
Yeah, so like Dr. Johnson mentioned, in its earliest stages, breast cancer doesn't have a symptom. This is why mammograms are so important. They're able to see these cancers before we know that something's there. Now, as a cancer grows, you know, we talked about those cells forming a tumor. Some women may feel a lump in the breast or under the arm. There could be a change in the size of the breast or how that breast looks. There might be skin or nipple changes, nipple discharge, thickening of the skin, redness, dimpling, indentations. Rarely breast cancers can cause some pain or discomfort. I tell my patients to know what's normal to them. All breasts are different. All women have different symptoms based on maybe their menstrual cycle or just their normal breast tissue. And it's difficult to know if something's abnormal if you don't know what's already normal to your breasts. Trust your instincts, pay attention to your body for changes. And if you think that there's something different, it's never wrong to mention it to your doctors or to your team.
You know, that's such an important point. I remember in reading about Olivia Newton-John and when she was first diagnosed, how she had negative mammography and negative testing, but she said that she trusted that something was not right and ultimately was found that she did have breast cancer. So I have to kind of agree with that point so much or emphasize it. Dr. Johnson, one of the areas that that has always gotten a lot of attention is breast self-examination. And I'm curious, in this world of mammography, the discussion about dense breasts, ultrasounds, what exactly is the role now of breast self-examination, especially in those women with dense breasts or breasts that are just naturally lumpy?
I think that this really illustrates the point that you have to work together as a team. So it's not one thing. The mammogram is a part of it. The clinical exam is a part of it. Any supplemental screening tests are a part of it. And I do think that your self-exam has a role. So a self-exam once a month, generally about 10 days after the start of your period if you're premenopausal, or you can just pick a day that you can remember if you're postmenopausal. You do a quick self-exam. And the goal is to, if you do a self-exam every month, you'll learn, like Beth was saying, you'll learn what's normal for you. And if you notice something that just doesn't seem right, I would just strongly encourage people to just get it checked out. It's very simple to do. It's better to be safe than sorry. I know that the self-exam has, it kind of waxes and wanes and whether it's recommended or not. I personally do think it has a role. Having said that, if it stresses you out and you feel like it causes more anxiety than it might help, then that's fine to skip it. But I try to just encourage people to really not stress about it. Just do a quick self-exam and you'll be amazed at how often even small changes, patients can really pick up on them if they've been doing self-exams regularly. I'd be interested to hear if Beth agrees in her experience, but in my experience, I'm always amazed at how often patients can detect really subtle changes.
Beth, you want to kind of chime in there?
Absolutely. Overwhelmingly, mammograms are probably the number one way that we're seeing breast cancers found, but I still think there's a role for self-awareness. And I used the term self-awareness rather than exam, because like Dr. Johnson said, the term exam can seem kind of intimidating and scary, but awareness is just being familiar with your body. We still have patients that find the change that might be that new breast cancer. So if a woman's comfortable with looking in the mirror, looking for changes, feeling their breasts, these are things that might help us to be able to identify things that might have been missed on a mammogram. Or, certainly for women that aren't quite to screening age for mammograms, finding something that just doesn't seem right could be that warning sign. So I agree. I think that there's still a role for it.
Beth, while I have you on this topic of the mammogram, let's try to kind of nail down the question that we get most often. When should you get a mammogram? And the second part of that, how often?
Ooh, these are tough questions. So I don't think even in medicine, we all completely agree. There's several different organizations that create guidelines on how we should screen for breast cancer. The majority of these guidelines agree that screening annual mammograms should start at age 40. A couple of our organizations are going to say age 45, age 40 to 50. Even the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force, they say age 50. But in general, starting at age 40. And again, in general, on an annual basis. A screening mammogram is done when there isn't any particular symptom or concern. But anytime that there is a new breast symptom or a change, that's when we would also recommend doing breast imaging.
Dr. Johnson, how effective are these mammogram procedures in women who have dense breast tissue? Are there other options in that scenario?
There are. I will say that the other options don't replace mammography. Mammography can be limited in patients with dense breasts because when we say dense breasts, all we mean is that there's more breast tissue relative to the amount of fat in that person's breast. The dense breast tissue on the mammogram shows up white. The fat shows up gray or black. So if you have a lot of white on the mammogram, it can hide cancers because they also show up white. I use the analogy sometimes with my patients. Imagine that there's a breast cancer and it's represented by a white carnation. And you put that carnation in a vase and you can see it no problem. But if you pile a bunch of white daisies representing dense breast tissue around that carnation, you can basically make it invisible. And so that's why dense breasts are a problem on mammography. Having said that, we detect early breast cancers in dense breasts all the time. It's just that it may be limited. Luckily, we have some options. There are basically two options that are out there at the moment. I would say, in widespread usage. One is screening ultrasound, which has some problems. It can be very good, but it has some limitations. And another option that's very recently become available is something called a fast MRI or an abbreviated MRI. And basically all that is it's the same machine that if you needed to get an MRI, your knee or your elbow or your shoulder, something like that, it's the same machine, but it uses some specialized equipment to take a quick look at the breast tissue. It takes about 10 to 15 minutes. And this is just to be very clear for patients that have dense breasts but are not at high risk otherwise. So they don't have any family history. Right. Really, their only issue is dense breasts. And so it gives us just another tool in the box. So we have mammography and ultrasound and MRI and self-exams or self-awareness, and I like that term a lot, and clinical evaluation. And if we put all those together, it really does increase our chances of detecting a breast cancer when it's most treatable.
Got it. Beth, what about molecular breast imaging?
Yeah, so that's a specialized nuclear medicine study. It's a fairly new test, and it is pretty limited availability. We have it at Mayo Clinic here in Jacksonville. And I like to think of this as kind of like a PET scan of the breast, if you've ever been exposed to someone you know with cancer care. We use specialized imaging to look for activity. So like Dr. Johnson mentioned, if you have the carnation hiding in the vase full of daisies, it's a way for us to light that carnation up so it stands out from the background around it. And so that's what molecular breast imaging lets us do, is using a radio tracer, so a small dose of radiation that can move through the breast tissue, can get picked up by a breast cancer so that it can show up for the radiologist to see if it might have hidden on a mammogram.
That's so great. Dr. Johnson, first, I want to also, I don't want to be remiss in congratulating you and your team on the 1 year anniversary of the HCA Memorial Women's Clinic here. And I wanted to make sure I asked you to tell us about the clinic and how it works for women as it relates to breast cancer.
So it's fantastic. It's very easy to get in and out of. It's beautiful. It's convenient. Women can stop in and get their mammograms. It's on Atlantic Boulevard near Kernan. And we're super excited to celebrate the 1 year anniversary with a breast health seminar and breakfast. And it's completely free. It's on October 15th from 8:30 until 10 a.m. And all you have to do is RSVP for a free seat. And that number is 800-530-3244. So we'll have a seminar and free breakfast and gifts and can get your mammogram to boot. So
I love it. I just wanted to make sure that I asked about that because that's always wonderful to have that resource here in our city. Let me get back into the kind of as we flow into the issues of now treating breast cancer. So Beth, let's say you find the lump and you're so concerned. That's what always happens. Everyone kind of freezes right then and there. What's the next step in that, in the management, if you will, if that's found?
Yeah, if you or if your doctor find a new lump, our next step is going to be diagnostic mammograms, and in some cases, an ultrasound to go along with that. So we've been talking to this point about screening mammograms. And I like to think of screening mammograms kind of like school picture day. Everybody comes in, they get their picture taken, they go home, and hopefully they get some good results. A diagnostic mammogram is more like glamour shots. It allows our technicians and our radiologists to take very specialized pictures to kind of zoom in, to magnify, to get a better idea of what's happening in the tissue. And then ultrasounds along with that can help with clarifying what might be causing this lump. Because while cancer can cause a lump, there's also benign changes that can happen in the breast. So we want to have an idea of what it might be. Now, if the radiologist identifies that there's a concerning finding, they may recommend additional imaging with maybe an MRI, or they might recommend a biopsy to get a sample of the cells, because we truly can't confirm a diagnosis of breast cancer without getting a sample of the cells from that tumor. If it looks like it's more of a benign finding, there might be a recommendation for short-term follow-up imaging. And this can sometimes feel a little bit confusing or overwhelming when you know that there's a lump, but it might be benign. So I encourage patients in those situations to continue to monitor. And then that way, if they notice any changes, to work closely with their team. And then after the biopsy, we get pathology results back that can tell us what might be happening in that tumor. And if there is something that's malignant, then we work together with a whole team of doctors, you know, surgeons, the oncologists, the radiation oncologists, to be able to make the best decisions for each individual patient.
That's terrific. I love how you kind of laid that out for us. Dr. Johnson, let's assume that you did find it. They found that indeed this is cancer. The biopsy came back. When is surgery required versus radiation or chemo? And in what cases do you have to take medications after that?
It really depends on a number of factors, including the size of the tumor, the location of the tumor, and then certain specific characteristics of the tumor. For example, is it what we call invasive, meaning it's spread outside of the milk ducts in the breast? It's not necessarily gone past the breast, but it's out of the milk ducts in the breast. Or is it in situ, which means it's confined to the milk ducts in the breast? And it can also be influenced by the hormonal status of the tumor. Is it reactive to hormones or not? And so all of those factors go together to determine whether a patient is recommended to have surgery. If so, what kind of surgery, and whether or not they need radiation or chemotherapy. And in fact, in some cases, chemotherapy is even given before anything else as the first line of treatment, but that's relatively unusual. But like I said, it really depends on a whole host of factors, primarily the size and location of the tumor and certain characteristics of the tumor itself.
Appreciate that. Isabella Da Silva, our director, joins us now with questions from our listeners for our experts.
Mr. Postman.
Isabella, welcome. What questions do we have today?
Hi, Dr. Servin. Simone from Pasadena, California. I was incredibly interested in Katie Couric's story, particularly the surgery she chose, which was a breast-sparing surgery. I am curious which surgery has a better overall survival rate, mastectomy or breast-sparing surgery?
Beth, you want to take that on? I know that was actually one of the highlights of kind of maybe controversy when it came up to her announcement.
Yeah, and you know, this is a big concern for women when they get a diagnosis of breast cancer, and it can be a big decision to make. But both procedures are equally effective for preventing a recurrence of breast cancer. Now, there's different factors to consider when discussing the different surgery options. A lumpectomy might have a quicker recovery, and it preserves more of the natural breast and sensation. But it's usually going to also come with treatment with radiation. Now, a lumpectomy might not be an option for everyone, especially if it's a larger tumor, or if that tumor is too close to certain areas, or depending on the characteristics of that tumor. Now, some women might choose mastectomy because they have a certain peace of mind that comes with complete removal of the breast, but it's a bigger surgery. The procedure itself takes longer, recovery may take longer, and may be accompanied by different complications. So another thing with mastectomy is considering reconstruction, there's usually gonna be other surgeries that come afterwards as part of reconstruction surgery. Now, one other thing to keep in mind, we kind of touched on genetic mutations, and this is one of those situations when a woman who gets diagnosed with breast cancer, it might also be helpful to know if she has a genetic mutation that puts her at a higher risk for getting breast cancer again down the road, because in some of these cases, a woman might choose to do that preventative mastectomy along with a treatment surgery just because of the risk for developing breast cancer in the future to the other breast.
That's super helpful. What else do we have, Isabella?
Nadia on Twitter. Can your experts comment on the clinical trials of breast cancer vaccines? Do these look promising? Do they foresee that breast cancer should be prevented? What is the theory behind it?
Dr. Johnson, Do you know of, to help us out with Nadia, I don't know a lot about breast cancer vaccines, but anything you could kind of help to help answer her question?
You know, I am not personally involved in any of those trials. I do know that obviously there's a huge interest in trying to come up with ways to prevent not only breast, but other forms of cancer as well. I think it's probably a ways off before it's going to be widely available, but I do know that those research studies are ongoing. I just personally have not been involved in any of those. I'm not sure if Beth has or not, but obviously we would love a way to prevent breast cancer from ever forming in the first place.
Yeah, I can comment to some of the work that's being done. This is research stages, but you know, they're not really studying it as a prevention for developing breast cancer, but more of the prevention of recurrence of certain breast cancers.
Oh.
So especially like the triple negative breast cancers. So right now it's not really looked at as a vaccine for, you know, a young woman against ever getting breast cancer, but it's more to protect an individual who may have already had a breast cancer that has a high recurrence rate to keep them from getting it again.
Thanks so much, Beth. Isabella, what else do we have?
Anonymous in Jacksonville asks, what is triple negative breast cancer?
Well, Beth, you did bring up triple negative a second ago, so I'll direct it to you.
I'll dive in. Yeah. So back to when we were talking about how there's different types of breast cancer, because, you know, we classify breast cancer in different ways based on its individual characteristics. But cancer has different receptors. So think of cancer as having a door. And to treat the cancer, you've got to open the door. The receptors that we're talking about are like having different locks on the door. And these locks are estrogen, progesterone, and the HER2-neu. We have different keys that we use to open these locks to destroy the cancer. So if a cancer is estrogen positive, we would use an anti-estrogen treatment. Or if it's HER2 positive, we have treatment specifically to target that HER2. Well, the challenge with a triple negative breast cancer is we don't have these receptors. So we don't have a lock that we can open with a key. We still do have chemotherapy to destroy this type of cancer, though. Only about 10 to 15% of breast cancers are triple negative, but they tend to be very aggressive. Their survivorship isn't as good as some of the other types. And so, we are trying to find some unique ways to battle this type of cancer.
Thanks so much for that. Isabella, what else do we have?
Anna, a med student in Phoenix. Because of the COVID pandemic, have breast cancer rates increased due to so many women putting off mammograms?
Dr. Johnson, can you comment on that? I mean, that I imagine was the other big bad part of COVID was no one got anything else done.
That was definitely a big concern at the time. There was there were a lot of the mammography centers that just weren't doing mammograms, and some of the breast surgeries were canceled, and you know, it was a very big deal. So we worked really hard once the center was back open and ready to go to get all of those patients that might have missed their mammogram during the closures back in. And the good news is that, you know, a few weeks to a couple of months is usually not going to make any difference as far as cancer detection and prognosis goes. But it's definitely a concern. And I think that people were so concerned about the risk of infection and getting COVID and all of those other factors. And maybe they were busy, you know, taking care of loved ones that were sick, that some of those preventive type tests like screening mammography got pushed back a little bit. So now that we're a couple of years out, I think that we've kind of caught up. But definitely at the time, that was a real concern. And there was a big push to get people back in as soon as those centers were open.
I'm going to let that be our last word. And I want to thank you, Dr. Diane Johnson. You have been so helpful to us. It's been wonderful talking to you. And also to Beth Boyer. We've loved having you join our show today. It's been so helpful and so illuminating. We want to thank you both.
Oh, thank you so much.
It's been our pleasure. We've been talking to Dr. Diane Johnson. She is medical director of the Breast Center at HCA Memorial Hospital here in Jacksonville, and Beth Boyer, a physician assistant at Mayo Clinic's Jacoby Center for Breast Health. Up next, WJCT's David Luckin joins us to talk about his breast cancer journey 1 year later. We'll be right back. This is What's Health Got to Do with It, and I'm Dr. Joe Servin. Today we're discussing breast cancer in honor of Breast Cancer Awareness Month. Although breast cancer occurs mainly in women, men can get it too. Many people do not realize that men have breast tissue and that they can develop breast cancer. The truth is that cells in nearly any part of the body can become cancerous and spread to other areas. According to the American Cancer Society, about 2,710 new cases of invasive breast cancer will be diagnosed in men, and about 530 men will die from breast cancer this year alone. One such case occurred in WJCT's own David Luckin, the executive producer of this program. We spoke to him last October after his diagnosis and treatment, and invited him back 1 year later to check in on his journey. David, welcome back to the program.
Thank you for having me.
It's so good to have you here. Well, let's start with the most basic question. How are you?
All's good. I don't really feel like there's any residual effects at all.
I
did well. No side effects from the pill because my breast cancer was estrogen-based, I guess you would say. So I'm on tamoxifen, which mitigates the production of estrogen, I'm guessing. But so far, so good. No side effects, which was what had me most concerned.
That is fantastic. Well, let's remind our listeners, how were you diagnosed? Tell us about that part.
I felt something funny on my breast left, and I had a mammogram, and they said nothing to worry about. And I probably should have chased it more because it lingered, and I still was scratching and touching and saying something's not right here, and I wasn't aggressive enough. So after a point, I did have a second mammogram, and then they said, you need to have some surgery.
So you really needed to trust your instincts on this.
And I probably could have been better at that. So I tell other people, if you feel something, you know, do something, say something, go talk to somebody. Don't just say, it's probably not that bad, or it'll go away. Like men tend to do,
yep.
You know, women, I think, are better chasing down medical issues than men. If it goes away, it's like, yeah, that's gone. We're good. But sometimes it's not gone. So
no. And I know that is such a truism from just my general practice. And to be honest with you, with myself as well. So
sure.
I get it. Was there any history of breast cancer in the family?
None.
So this
makes me extra special.
I know you just mentioned tamoxifen, but what treatments did you undergo before you got there?
We did a full mastectomy, and then we did chemotherapy, not radiation. And that was four rounds, which I think is nothing compared to a young man I met who did 21 rounds. And you just think, 21 rounds, how did you do it? And it's obviously different for everyone, but I feel lucky it was only four rounds.
And then after that was just the oral medication that you had to take?
For the next... I guess 9 more years.
So
a 10-year program is what my doctor told me.
Wow. And but so far, no side effects, no problems.
Nope.
That is fantastic.
Is it because I take it at night and then go to sleep and I sleep through the side effects? That may be an issue, but that's what the doctor recommended, was take it at night, go to bed, and wake up fine.
But whatever works is the key.
Yeah, it's working so far.
Let me ask, you know, here we are a year later, four rounds of chemo, you're on tamoxifen, all of the shock that this came through. What was the toughest thing about this whole experience?
I have to be totally honest, it was the pain in the stomach from the chemo.
Okay.
The mental part, I'm good with that. You know, we do what we have to do, we carry on. the physical part is different for everyone. I was lucky that I didn't have a lot of other side effects from chemo that I've read about and heard from other people. For me, it was just an incredibly bad stomach ache. It just was there for, you know, it would wear off after your 21 days and then it would come back with your next treatment. But all that went away. Once this is all done, everything's back to what I think is normal.
And appetite and everything was all good as well.
I've never been a big eater anyway. So I think that did change a little. I'm not so interested in food, even food I like. I'll eat half a plate of something and say, yeah, I'm good. Okay. But I've never been a big eater. So I'm not sure if that's a result of this or not, but it didn't help not being a big eater. And then the chemo, because everything tastes kind of funny. It's not that it tastes bad. It's just that it doesn't taste that good, if you know what I mean.
I do.
So the things you think you really like, and I was trying everything. Boy, we'll put some barbecue sauce on this. It'll make it better. You know, just trying to fix things that you always ate before, but somehow it's not quite the same. But I think that's pretty back to normal now.
Okay. Let me, as someone who has a condition that often has the reverse issue, which is women are more identified with it. Did you ever encounter stigma over any of this?
Don't know, don't care.
Got it.
No, I mean, I made lots of jokes for myself and my family. You know, I do wear pink a lot more than I used to. I call Donna every now and then. But no, I'm not going to get hung up on any of that stuff. You know, you got a physical problem. Hopefully, if you have a good mental state, it will help the physical.
Gotcha.
I'd hate to have both of them on the fritz at the same time. It would not be good.
Well, let me ask that. You brought up mental state. How did you keep yourself grounded in order to get through all of the stuff you had to do?
I think what worked was I kept working.
Okay.
I just kept working. I worked from home a lot, you know, wrote scripts, did some voicing. And that just kept it going. But the funny thing is with the chemo is you'll be doing really well and then they knock you down again and then you do really well. So it's this roller coaster. Every 21 days when you feel like you're back, then they knock you down again. So my employers were flexible and I worked from home. And I think that's probably the most positive thing I did was just keep working, you know.
Kind of keep your mind active.
Yeah.
Distracted.
Absolutely. Distracted and active and, you know, watch a few old Humphrey Bogart movies and take my mind off it. But I have a pretty good attitude anyway. I'm mostly an optimist. So, I can say all that when they say it's only stage one, you know,
heaven forbid
if it would have been stage four, this conversation would be completely different. So,
well, let me ask you a kind of a similar other question, like in this vein, what do you think now, as you look back, was the most surprising thing about all of this?
Well, I guess just the big C word, you know. I mean, in a way, it didn't surprise me at all. I've thought my whole life, you know, if I was always told 1 in 5 people get cancer. We had 7 kids in my family and 2
wow.
parents. So it was inevitable. And we were bragging right up to me and my sister. She had thyroid cancer.
Okay.
And we were the 2 ones who saved the other 7 because we did it for them. So I'm not really surprised because it seems like my whole life, that's always something that people talk about, you know, whether it's smoking cigarettes or in the food or, you know, how healthy do you eat? Or I just kind of took it in stride.
And I think you just answered one of the questions I had to have coming, if there were any risks that you have. And it sounds like not really.
Not really. No, okay. Just keep a positive attitude. And what's really important is for other men out there, if you feel something, it's probably something.
Got it.
You know, don't ignore it because you might not be as lucky as me. Stage one is pretty lucky. Stage four. Not so lucky.
No, I'm with
so,
you.
So it be aware. And I do some self-exam now. I'm not obsessed with it, but sometimes if I'm just sitting there watching TV, I'll just do a quick feel and make sure everything feels right.
Which is good advice for everyone out there. I understand that you're working on raising awareness of breast cancer in both men and women. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
I have joined the Cancer Society and put up on my Facebook page a fundraiser to raise awareness and funds for research. So that's really what I've done. I'm doing this. I'm going to do a lunch and learn for J&J in a couple weeks. I'm just trying to raise awareness because, as you say, it's 1 in 1,000, 1 in 2,000 men.
Right.
So don't think it can't happen to you. You know, check yourself out. And if you see something, feel something, do something.
Well, let me on that last point there and really in our last minute or so, if someone is out there and they find themselves with this diagnosis, man or woman, doesn't matter, what advice? What do you want to tell them at this point with regards to this?
I'm one who takes my doctor's advice. I mean, I think the first thing you do is go to someone you respect. I think a referral is really good. I referred some people to the doctors I had. They like that doctor better than the one they had. So I think a lot of it is networking, and I trust my doctors. I went to a dermatologist first, and she looked and said, oh, no, you're going to my friend. And I went to her friend, a surgeon, and everything she told me she was going to do, she did. So I'm one who follows the advice. And I don't chase, you know, conspiracies, but, you know, all the craziness online,
sure.
You know, I don't. You could really, you know, bum yourself out if you read all the possibilities, like all the side effects of tamoxifen, no one would take it.
Sure.
So my feeling is my doctor said, take it. If it doesn't work out, we'll go somewhere else.
Well, David, I want to thank you so much for joining us. And most importantly, congratulations on an amazing 1 year. You're here.
Absolutely.
We're delighted. And I think you're helping a lot of folks. Thanks so much for joining us
today. Thank you for taking the time.
We've been talking to David Luck, and he's the executive producer of this show, What's Health Got to Do With It, here at WJCT News 89.9. Well, that's our program for today. We hope you've enjoyed our show. If you missed anything, you can listen to the full episode at WJCT.org and on your favorite podcast app. Thanks to all of our guests. Our executive producer is David Luckin. Heather Schatz is our senior producer. Isabella Da Silva is our director. Next week's program will feature a conversation with the president of the American Medical Association. If you have questions for him or about any other subject, let us know by calling us at 904-358-6362. Emailing us at health@wjct.org or tweeting me at jservin. I'm Dr. Joe Servin, and you're listening to What's Health Got to Do With It on WJCT News 89.9 Jacksonville. Thank you for listening, and stay in touch.
Sponsored in part by Eli Lilly and Company. Is migraine impacting your life or daily activities 4 or more days per month? If so, ask your healthcare professional if you are a candidate for migraine prevention treatments and which ones might be best for you. Learn more at thinkmigraine.com. And the American Brain Foundation. For over 30 years, the foundation has worked with researchers to discover better treatment, prevention, and cures for brain diseases and disorders. Imagine life without brain disease. Learn more at AmericanBrainFoundation.org. And by the Epilepsy Foundation leads the fight to overcome the challenges of living with epilepsy and to accelerate therapies, stop seizures, find cures, and save lives. Visit epilepsy.com to find out how to get involved today.